Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. In one of the most critical battlefronts, namely the war of ideas, Benjamin Weingarten has been making an outsized contribution, I think, through such outlets as The Federalist, the London Center for Policy Research, where he is a senior fellow, and notably through his new and very topical book, American Ingrate, Ilhan Omar and the Progressive Islamist Takeover of the Democratic Party. He is also the founder and CEO of Change Up Media and a good friend of this program. We are always delighted to have him, especially for an hour-long conversation, which we will have with him today. Ben Weingarten, welcome back. It's so good to have you. We are really thrilled to be able to visit with you about a number of things that CV of yours invites. Let me start with a follow-up to the very interesting conversation we had with you a week or two ago about American Ingrate. Ilhan Omar, the focus of your assessment, the congresswoman from Minnesota, originally from Somalia, a member of the Squad, has uncharacteristically recently commended Donald Trump for his leadership in the pandemic crisis. I personally think he deserves commendation, but it seems unlikely coming from this particular source. As a man who has studied her closely, what did you make of it?
Well, I think if there was ever a sign that the world is ending, this is that sign. I think that it's notable that Ilhan Omar was not praising the president in context of taking necessary steps to dramatically cut bureaucratic red tape, to allow treatments to get to market far more quickly than they had been. It's not a celebration of the president calling for the halt of all transportation to and from China weeks in advance of this pandemic metastasizing. It was largely for the emergency economic measures, which were in large part aimed at easing the burden on millions of Americans, given the wages of the economic devastation transpiring as we enter essentially a civil society shutdown, which has obvious catastrophic consequences to it. And Ilhan Omar is praising the president for example, lessening the burden on students who have education loans to pay back, on homeowners, those with lower incomes in the service industry were disproportionately affected. And she's praising those measures because she wishes those measures existed all the time, not temporarily, not just in the case of an emergency. So I think the key takeaway is that Democrats like herself are viewing this as a crisis they can take advantage of to push for policies that they wish existed in all times, not just in de facto, if not de jure, wartime. And so from their perspective, they will look back on this when we sort of arise from this and awake from the trauma months down the road. And they'll say, look, we put those measures in place then. We should make those measures permanent. And that is unfortunately the difficult consequence that we have to be eagle-eyed about when it comes to measures taken during a crisis.
I think that's very well put. Let me try to paraphrase what you've said here to put a fine point on it. What Donald Trump is being praised for by Ilhan Omar is embracing some of the, well, big government, I guess is one way of describing it, even perhaps socialist measures that she and other so-called progressives, who, as you've described in your book, are taking over the Democratic Party, in her case, the progressive Islamist wing of that movement. They are thrilled with the institution of these kinds of arrangements, even if it's just on a temporary basis, in the hope that they will be able to pocket them and parlay the precedent into a permanent retirement arrangement that will involve similar kinds of arrangements, nanny state or government handouts, free stuff, however you want to call it, programs for the foreseeable future, not just for the moment. If I got that right?
Yes, and absolutely. It's very well stated. And the other point to make, and one of the things that this crisis should underscore when hopefully we're looking back on this having recovered in months, is we have to have our fiscal house in order. And the fact that a pandemic such as this causes these trillion-dollar measures to take place, which further blow out a budget that is already out of control in terms of debt and deficits as far as the eye can see, underscores the imperative that we get our fiscal house in order, because down the road there will be future shocks to the system, black swan events that may well require substantially bigger interventions. But I think the core point is that the progressives are trying to use this opportunistically. It's very telling that the piece of legislation, the original piece of legislation that came out of the House in, I guess, phase one of the sort of crisis plan that's unfolding, had basically every leftist measure you could ever ask for and nothing conservative in it. So I think it's telling from the perspective of understanding how those on the left think about a crisis that they have all of their agenda items picked out, ready to go. And we on the conservative side are often reacting defensively. I think we should react equally offensively, which is to say those measures that are being undertaken on an emergency basis here that allow for the opening of the marketplace to grapple with these sorts of problems, those should be made permanent.
Let's hope that will be the case. I don't see much prospect of getting our economic house in order, but there are some steps that the president has taken, regulatory red tape clearing and the like, that if made permanent or built upon could help in that regard. I did want to ask you, as an example of what you're talking about in terms of the left capitalizing on the crisis, reportedly they managed to insinuate into some of this legislation, I'm not quite sure whether it's the bill that's already been approved or the one that is now in the works, but some language that would essentially push forward the Green New Deal agenda. Evidence of, again, the progressive takeover of the Democratic Party that you write about in American Ingrate. Give us just a quick sense of what that portends if it's allowed to materialize.
Well, essentially what that would push towards is, beyond the obvious disastrous economic impact, the whole basis of the Green New Deal, so-called, is the deindustrialization of our economy, which would mean pure economic devastation for private industry, the hyper-regulation of essentially every single industry, the collapse of our energy sector, which has been one of the key driving forces, if not the key driving force, in economic growth, certainly during the Obama years and continuing during the Trump years, in spite of Obama's best efforts to destroy that industry. So, first of all, it's shameless that they would be trying to insert something like that in a piece of emergency legislation. But second of all, the consequences of it for the economy would be disastrous. But really, the consequences for liberty in America would be disastrous. And that's one of the things that we should always keep in mind here.
Ben Weingarten, we have to pause. We'll be right back with more with the author of American Ingrate, Ilhan Omar, and the Progressive Islamist Takeover of the Democratic Party.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. We are visiting for this full hour, I'm pleased to say, with Benjamin Weingarten, a senior contributor at The Federalist and the author of American Ingrate, Ilhan Omar, and the Progressive Islamist Takeover of the Democratic Party. Ben, you were describing the agenda of the progressive Islamists in the Democratic Party being not simply to, well, as Barack Obama famously put it, fundamentally transform the United States of America, but to do so in a way that would be, I have to say, so devastating to this country, both economically, as you've indicated, and politically, and in terms of the very character of our republic and the freedoms that it enshrines. This sounds an awful lot like the agenda of globalists and particularly of the Chinese Communist Party. And these things have become much more, I believe, a matter of public scrutiny. Fortunately, it's the one of very few upsides of this coronavirus crisis is people are looking afresh at what the Chinese communists are up to and specifically what we have essentially allowed them to do to us through this so-called engagement with China. Talk, if you would, a little bit about that agenda and how it tracks with what you've been warning about in terms of our own domestic political development, this radicalization of the Democratic Party here.
I think it's very well stated, Frank. Certainly, to the extent that the U.S. economy is shackled with hyper-regulation, its energy sector, a major motor of our economy, is left in ruins. Certainly, the shutdown of essentially our entire economy, even for a temporary period, has any number of knock-on effects that even go beyond economic devastation, of course, works to the benefit of all of our worst adversaries. With respect to coronavirus and the Chinese link to coronavirus, where it always bears repeating, it started in China, it spread in China, the Chinese Communist Party sought to suppress information about it rather than suppressing the actual spread of it, and now are engaged in an information operation to try to deflect, obfuscate over what transpired, and then even blame Americans potentially, and the U.S. military in particular, for having brought it to Wuhan province in the first place. This is an episode that perfectly illustrates the nature of that totalitarian communist regime, which is to say they're acting just like the Soviet Union did during Chernobyl, where they tried to cover it up, whitewash it, and now even more brazenly are trying to deflect blame. And where this links with America are twofold. One is the fact that we have finally awakened to the tremendous, potentially devastating implications of the fact that so much of our medicine and medical supplies are produced in China. So we are usually reliant on them for any number of drugs that Americans use on a daily basis, as well as much of the equipment, the medical supplies that we could use during a crisis such as this. And in one of China's propaganda rags, English language rags, they have actually essentially threatened to not share some of those products with us to the extent we continue to point the finger at them, which is where the finger should be pointed in this crisis. But the more shameful aspect of it is that you have American media and even politicians who are not focused on pointing the finger where it deserves to be blamed and then doing everything that we possibly can to prudently and responsibly deal with this pandemic on our shores. But they're attacking other Americans by saying that the verbiage that we use to describe what I call the Chi-Com coronavirus, but the Chinese coronavirus or the Wuhan virus or Wuhan flu, that is racist. And that is exactly the propaganda emanating from the Chinese Communist Party, which, and as I wrote about this in the Federalist earlier this week or about a week ago, that puts Americans in the place of acting as unregistered foreign agents for the Chinese Communist Party. And that is not only a disastrous propaganda coup for the Chinese Communist Party while we waste energy on this, but second of all, it just shows a fundamental unseriousness in the country that we are talking about the lexicon that we use in the face of a pandemic. American life and limb is at risk, and how much airtime has been wasted on political correct virtue signaling. We should not be having PC policing among our so-called elites during the time of a crisis like this. And again, I think it shows a fundamental unseriousness among them that has calamitous consequences for the American people.
And as you said, Ben, it would be bad under the best of circumstances to have our time and energies diverted into this kind of political warfare. But the fact that it is in the service, whether that's the intent or not, can be debated, but that it is in the service of our enemies. And I think that's the term that most Americans now recognize as appropriate with respect to the Chinese, not just in terms of their propaganda, but in their own political warfare against us, their efforts to dominate other nations, to dominate ultimately the world. It's all being accelerated now, I think, by the present crisis and their efforts, as you've indicated, to sort of jujitsu their responsibility for it into now their narrative that, as I'm fond of saying, communism is a cure for the coronavirus. Their totalitarian crackdown at home and now their ability to provide masks and medicines and other things to select nations is all in the service of their larger agenda, I'm afraid, and we're abetting it at our extreme peril. There's a lot to talk about here, Ben, and I want to sort of tease out with you a couple of things. You have properly called attention to this phenomenon of Chinese propaganda and their efforts to manipulate public opinion and to distort reality. We're watching this at a moment when I think increasingly, you're right, Americans are concerned about the reality. And the reality is, as our friend Rosemary Gibson pointed out, among other places in a program that we did with the Committee on the Present Danger China yesterday, it's going to be available at presentdangerchina.org. She's, of course, the author of China RX and was the first, I think, really to sound the alarm 2 years ago now about our dependency on China for medicine. But talk a little bit, if you would, Ben, about sort of this as a microcosm of the larger problem of the deindustrialization. This is not just a future threat. This is something that's already happened. And the posture it puts this country in relative to an increasingly, obviously hostile China.
Yeah, well, let me say first that the Chinese Communist Party has to try to distort public opinion and engage in these influence operations to try to deflect blame and then cause discord in foreign countries over where this arose and who's to blame for its spread and the like, precisely because the Chinese Communist Party recognizes that if people do really awaken to what has transpired here and all of the knock-on effects, that this poses an existential threat to their march for global domination. And so we focus in particular on the Chinese coronavirus from the perspective of the supply chain relating to medical supplies. But if we tease that out a little bit and we look at it from a 30,000 foot view, the Chinese Communist Party de facto, again, if not de jure, has a role to play in the global supply chains impacting every strategically significant area in American life. And the Trump administration, under, I believe, a joint project by Peter Navarro, who runs the Trade and Manufacturing Bureau, as well as the DOD, did a study, I believe, a couple of years ago, showing that there were more than 300, maybe even 400 gaps in sort of our defense industrial base. And what that means is America can't produce essential military hardware without reliance on other foreign countries, including among them China. And the reality is that no country can long survive to the extent it requires supply chains that go through hostile adversaries. And what we are finally awakening to here is the existential threat posed by a China when our supply chains in all of these vital areas run through it. And that includes everything from precious resources to components that go into our most critical military hardware, again, to the medicine and medical supplies that impact American life and limb. So again, if there is a silver lining of this and we can get past this information operation that's transpiring that is wasting time and energy and resources, and we look at the big picture here, the big picture is that this episode crystallizes exactly why we cannot rely on China for anything, period, full stop. And that is why the Chinese Communist Party is fighting so hard to stop there from being any transparency with respect to what happened in Wuhan and beyond, and to try to get us divided ourselves. And the fact, again, that our elite, mainly our progressives, are playing into their hands is an unmitigated disaster, because now is the perfect time for us to look with clear, crystal clear vision at what is transpiring in China, how it impacts the U.S., and the absolute imperative to decouple at a minimum from every strategically significant sector possible and have our own production capacity in the U.S. for all of these vital areas.
Ben Weingarten, you've already indicated in that context that we are looking at a long-standing agenda that has been all too successful on the part of the globalists and the progressives, namely the deindustrialization of the United States. It's quite far advanced. It's fed into this Chinese communist industrial policy as well. And the idea of turning this thing around, the necessity for doing so, and the opportunities that are now before us under President Trump, with the Defense Production Act being invoked, for example, seems to me to be, again, one of the few potential upsides of this present crisis. And I appreciate so much you're specifically focusing on the imperative need to decouple from China, to restore our self-reliance with respect to particularly medicines, most obviously, but a whole host of other programs. And not least, this idea of, you know, having our military, for heaven's sakes, be independent of Chinese sources of supplies, a country against which we may well need to be, you know, using those military forces in the not too distant future if the Chinese threat continues to metastasize as it is at the moment. There's much more to talk about in this and other regards. Ben, I'm anxious particularly to figure out with you how the globalist global government agenda is now playing into this pandemic crisis and what the Chinese may have in mind in terms of their own vision of global governance right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back and continuing this really fascinating conversation with Ben Weingarten, the author of American Ingrate, Ilhan Omar and the Progressive Islamist Takeover of the Democratic Party. Really required reading. I commend it to all of you. You can also follow his writings as a senior contributor at The Federalist and his work more generally at the London Center for Policy Research, where he is a senior fellow. Ben, you've sort of laid out for us the agenda of the radical left. It seems to track generally with that of globalists, and it would appear the Chinese communists. They may have somewhat different end states in mind, but they all seem to have as a shared purpose trying to take down our country and its ability to, well, both preserve the freedoms that we often take for granted here, but also to be a bulwark against the sort of sovereignty sapping and ultimately world dominating agenda of these various adversaries. Let me ask you specifically about this event 201. I've referred to it on the program a couple of times. It was a tabletop exercise, I guess is how it's described, that was conducted back in October in New York City with individual actors and organizations that are very, very deeply invested in the globalist agenda, like the Davos World Economic Forum and the Bill Gates and David Rockefeller Foundations, the UN Foundation, the Centers for Disease Control in this country, and interestingly, in communist China as well. And the upshot of this exercise was, it seems, that the prospect of a global coronavirus pandemic would be conducive to building up global governance, filling its coffers, and otherwise empowering institutions like the World Health Organization and the UN to become much more dominant in the post-pandemic environment. I don't know if you've had a chance to study this roadmap closely, Ben, but suffice it to say for the present purpose that that was the vision. How is this now looking in terms of a prospect for all of us in this actual pandemic environment?
Well, first, let me say, I think your main point, one of your main points, bears reiterating, which is the idea that what the Chinese Communist Party has in mind is at a minimum analogous to what globalists and progressives have in mind, which is they all want total power and control. They may differ in how to achieve it. They may have different goals for those in power about what they wish to gain from that power and control. But that is the agenda. And what is so ironic about what you lay out is that the response to the pandemic and why this pandemic arose and spread and has all of these devastating knock-on consequences in the first place is actually a consequence of globalization, is a consequence of the lack of devotion to the concept of a nation state and the sovereign and the power of sovereignty that a nation state brings. So from the perspective of using a crisis to then impose even greater controls, consolidate more power, say that as a result of this, we need to have more global coordination and more global control over things, beyond the fact that all of these top-down institutions from the WHO on have completely failed in this process. And setting aside the fact that China is trying to leverage this chaos to set itself as a model somehow for dealing with crises because they impose totalitarian control and claim that they've gotten under control themselves, although I think the numbers out of China are completely dubious and should be looked at completely skeptically, in particular, given that they're kicking out Western reporters from the country, so there's truly no transparency on the ground there. The ironic thing about all of this is that every element of this pandemic essentially proves the case against globalization, proves the case against eviscerating the notion of sovereignty. If anything, it shows that nation states must be self-reliant and independent. There are obvious upsides to having global supply chains in terms of from a purely economic efficiency perspective, but it's clear that the downsides are also manifest. So what I would suggest is that this would be an interesting way for the globalists in the world to try to end run around institutions that are all demonstrating failure and against the populist movements that have arisen precisely because of that failure around the world. But I think it's going to backfire on them because populations across the world look at this with clear eyes. They see the reality of it. They feel it in their own communities. This is not something that can be dusted under the rug, that this is a clear consequence of globalization and being ever more inextricably intertwined, in particular, with a power like the Chinese Communist Party. I think this will definitely backfire on their agenda. But obviously, the establishment, the status quo power forces will capitalize to some extent. There's no question about it. The House generally wins. But in this case, I think the long-term consequences for the globalists could end up being disastrous, which would be a boon to America and to freedom around the world.
Yeah, I think that's right, Ben. The interesting thing I addressed in my commentary today is that one of the prime movers behind this transnationalist program has historically been the European Union. And one of the immediate casualties of the pandemic has been the so-called Schengen zone that was established back in 1985 that essentially eliminated the internal borders of the European Union and further diminished the sovereignty, even the identity, I would argue, of the members' states. This has been supplanted, of course, by even Germany, the prime champion of the Schengen zone, with the reinstitution of borders and border controls that are essentially reestablishing, I think, those nation states' sovereignty in a way that might have been unimaginable just a few months ago. This is hopefully going to create new departures from the EU, and I think rebuild Europe as a nation, as a continent of nation states, many of whom are important allies of ours and hopefully will be bulwarks against what the Chinese communists have in mind. Ben, there's been some talk, and I'd like to sort of get your thoughts on this. Senator Josh Hawley, I think, is the most recent to have sort of enunciated it last night on Tucker Carlson's show on Fox News, that there ought to be some kind of cost to the Chinese for what they've unleashed on the world, reparations, some have called it. Do you anticipate that this is something that might actually be feasible? And if so, how might it eventuate? Any ideas?
I suspect that this is a policy that will be far more popular with the American public broadly than their purported representatives, and certainly those who have a vested interest in maintaining something akin to the status quo with respect to China. It bears noting, one point that I think bears noting here in all of this chaos is that the left, the media, and others attacking the notion of a Chinese coronavirus as racist are all aligned over the fact that they want to maintain the status quo with respect to China, and they view Trump as the biggest bulwark against China and against, as you've described it, this sort of globalist movement. So there is a place where their desires intersect, which is to see Trump ousted in 2020 because he's the biggest threat to the Chinese communist plans for global domination, and obviously the left hates him to begin with. So I think the challenge in passing any sort of piece of legislation, which I think is 100% absolutely merited and should be hammered home day after day, that China is responsible for this and they bear a cost, is you are going to have a mass of forces against that, which again demonstrates that at least among our elites who are disproportionately influential, and that's in our corporations, in our government, in our media, and elsewhere, that they are still kowtowing to the Chinese Communist Party, even though this should have been a huge wake-up call for them, that America must be put first. It's an imperative for the life and limb of their own families that America be put first. So I hope, I think any legislation around this concept of reparations from the Chinese Communist Party is absolutely 100% merited, but I am very pessimistic that we are on the necessary wartime footing in this pandemic, that there actually will be a push among our purported representatives to make it happen.
Well, this is an important point, Ben, and I think it remains to be seen whether legislation is in fact the way this might be accomplished. It may be that there are some executive actions that the president could take would affect a reparation, if you wish, or at least cost penalty to the Chinese in some other form. We'll be watching this closely, as I know will you at The Federalist. Ben Weingarten, your mention of the corporate elites calls to mind one other facet that I think is now in sharp focus at last in connection with this crisis. It's something that we at the Committee on the Present Danger China have been really trying very hard to raise awareness about, and that is the degree to which our capital markets have been actually underwriting much of what the Chinese are up to the tune, by some estimates, of $3 trillion that have been transferred from American investors, primarily to the Chinese Communist Party and its companies. This is another form of globalization. It is another form of, I think, misbegotten policy, but it is also having a very material effect on the degree to which we face a real, present, and growing danger from Communist China. People, again, can find more out about all of this at presentdangerchina.org, and also by staying tuned, because Ben Weingarten and I are going to talk further about it on the other side of this short message. Be right back, right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We're visiting, and this is our fourth and final installment of that visit, with Benjamin Weingarten, a terrific freedom fighter in the War of Ideas at The Federalist, where he's a senior contributor at the London Center for Policy Research, where he's a senior fellow, and in connection with his authorship of American Ingrate. Ben, we've covered a lot of ground here, but I wanted to just come back to something we touched on at the end of the last segment, namely China's benefiting from our capitalists, specifically our financial sectors, determination to invest the retirement funds and other indexes and so on in Chinese companies, including some very directly tied, of course, not just to the Chinese Communist Party, but to the People's Liberation Army in some cases, and engaging in things like building weapons with which to kill us or to use technologies to oppress the people of China, including Uyghur Muslims and Christians and Tibetans and the like. This is a scandal, it seems to me. And when you talk about the need for correctives to this kind of general globalist approach, this would be a high priority, don't you think?
This is probably the biggest story of all, is the fact that under the guise, at least, of economic liberalization leading to political liberalization, those in the business world have dramatically expanded their operations in China, underwritten China, as you've noted, via giving them access to our capital markets and enabling them to raise billions, if not trillions of dollars cumulatively over history. We have essentially underwritten the communists so that they can build the ropes with which to hang us, if we're going to extend that old analogy. And it is the ultimate scandal. It is also, from the Chinese perspective, why they have so much leverage and probably feel so confident in pursuing their global strategy, in that so much money on so many different levels is tied up with the idea of building up China's economy, maintaining our market access to China, allowing China to build out its productive capacity, all, by the way, while they steal hundreds of billions of dollars of intellectual property as well on an annual basis. It is the ultimate scandal. It is what makes them such a formidable foe, because you have so many people who have a vested interest in maintaining the status quo. Where I think we have to get to as a country is the idea that China economic liberalization did not lead to political liberalization. In fact, it just made the Communist Party all that much stronger, gave it all that much more leverage over America. It's a hostile adversary, and you don't subsidize and underwrite a hostile adversary. So it's imperative that we have this decoupling from all of these strategically significant areas. But even more so, there needs to be a shift in the thinking of our business community, which is to understand that if you believe in this country, you love this country, and you want your children to have a bright future here and your children's children to have a bright future here, we need to separate from the Chinese Communist Party in a meaningful way. And that means dramatic changes in our capital markets, in how we do business, in our global supply chains and beyond, because it's about U.S. survival at the end of the day. And as you noted, the notion that we're funding the PLA alone is just asinine.
Amen. Ben, let me just ask you about this one particularly urgent, relevant topic, and that is the prospect that the individuals involved in overseeing the Federal Retirement Thrift Savings Plan for our military personnel and our civilian government employees are poised, as we speak, to move billions of dollars in their retirement funds into Chinese companies as well. Your thoughts on the advisability of that initiative, especially against the backdrop of what we've just been discussing?
I guess I would respond with a simple question, which is there any act that our worst adversaries could more support than an act such as that? And the example should be set at the top, which is to say that when it comes to these retirement funds for those in the U.S. government, obviously, none of those funds should be used to go into backing ventures that are Chinese Communist Party affiliated, many of which are hostile towards the U.S. and aimed at our destruction. And the problem is that we're seeing this not just in pension funds associated with the U.S. government employees, but as well with all manner of index funds, which are increasing their weightings towards Chinese Communist Party backed or at a minimum affiliated companies. It's just absolutely suicidal. If you were in the Chinese position, you would be laughing at the fact that Americans are operating with such willful blindness and naivete. But I go back to the idea that a lot of this is driven by not only that naivete, but also a level of greed associated with maintaining these Communist Party ties. But the reality is that greed is a very short-term and myopic way to look at a country that you're trading with that ultimately seeks your destruction. That's what has to be understood by every American and internalized. And this coronavirus should be a perfect example of it. I don't know how many more examples we need.
The American people seem to be getting it. The folks who run companies like BlackRock in the Wall Street world don't. And that may be because they're profiting massively from these kinds of transactions. Interestingly, the fellow who runs BlackRock, which manages the funds for the Thrift Savings Plan, is a fellow by the name of Larry Fink. And as you may know, Ben Weingarten at Davos last month, he announced that his firm was no longer going to give top priority to return on investment of those who are giving it money to invest. Instead, it's going to be prioritizing something called environment, social justice, and governance, or ESG. Tell us a little bit about that project, the ESG, and the advisability of pursuing it as the top priority for not just BlackRock with its immense wealth under management, but the various companies that Larry Fink is now trying to coerce into conforming to his priorities.
Yes. Well, in the case of BlackRock in particular, it's the largest asset manager in the world. It manages more funds than any other asset manager. So it has huge power over the companies through which investors through BlackRock gain entree. And so they are trying to leverage their power as a player in the marketplace to force companies with which they invest or even potentially divest from those companies who don't essentially toe the progressive line on, as you mentioned, environmental standards, so coal companies, for example, on sustainability and on so-called governance. What I suggest, and I wrote an article about this recently at The Federalist, is that, first of all, BlackRock is not alone. There are a number of major multinational corporations who are all in on this ESG agenda, who no longer believe that creating maximum value, maximizing value for their shareholders is the responsibility of a corporation, that it has all of these other responsibilities, many of them which are about social justice, serving UN environmental standards, for example. But what I suggest is that they're acting like total hypocrites, because while they talk about their ESG desires and wanting their progressive values, wanting to imbue their progressive values in the businesses in which they invest and with which they partner, the reality is that they are all major investors, or at least in one way or another, their profits are tied to China and ultimately then the Chinese Communist Party that controls it. And China fails on every level of ESG. There is no justice in China. And first of all, let me just say, I always say this, justice needs no modifier. The notion of social justice means essentially abrogating everyone's justice to impose progressive values on those groups who deserve retribution for their past purported ills. What I would suggest is that China is the last place we should look to for any type of justice, modified or not. It is a place that brooks no dissent, in which there is no rule of law, in which at the end of the day, the party is all-powerful, omnipotent, and we should never look towards it in any sort of justice context. And so again, it's a total violation of so-called ESG principles to have anything to do with China and the Chinese Communist Party.
Amen. Ben Weingarten, so much more to discuss with you, but we are hard out of time at the moment. This has been an extraordinarily informative and, well, challenging conversation with you. I think challenging in the sense that we need to rise to this challenge of China, and you've given us a lot of good ideas as to how to do that. I thank you for the work that you continue to do at The Federalist and at the London Center. And of course, I'm so proud of you for your book about Ilhan Omar, American Ingrate. I hope you come back to us again soon for a further visit. Ben, in the meantime, stay well. I hope the same will apply to all the rest of you. Come back to us on Monday. And in the meantime, be careful. Stay well. This is Frank Gaffney. Over and out.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.